Chuck Shoot Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. Devin Bronson, my guest today, someone you may not know, but you've definitely heard of the people he's worked with. Avril Lavigne, he was his guitar player for a long time. He's also worked with Pink, Demi Lovato, Derek Whibley from Sum 41, and my personal favorite, Sebastian Bach from Skid Row, which is how I discovered him. He's clearly very talented, and he does music for TV and film. So you've heard his stuff on The Hills, Californication, 22 Jump Street, tons more stuff. But he really hasn't done a lot of interviews that I've seen. So this is a good chance to get to know who he is. He's a super nice guy, very down to earth, really fun to chat with. And I really enjoyed our conversation. And I hope you guys dig it too. Check it out. Welcome, Devin Bronson, to the Chuck Shoot Podcast. This is quite a treat. I'm a fan for sure. You've got quite a resume. I didn't even know a lot of the other artists that you worked with until I started doing my research for the show. But Sebastian Bach was the one that drew me to you.
Nice. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah. So now, are you from Seattle as well? Or you were at least born there, right?
I'm from Seattle. Yeah, I was born in Burien, outside of Seattle. That's where my family's from.
Oh, okay. Now, and so how long did you live there until you moved to California?
My family moved when I was probably 8 or 9 years old. So I didn't have any real formative years there, but would go back every summer to visit the grandparents and family that still lived there.
Okay. So mostly California is where you've grown up then?
Mostly California. Yeah.
Okay. So then your favorite band is Cheap Trick. How did you get into Cheap Trick? Cause you almost seem like too young to be getting into Cheap Trick. That's gotta be like your parents or somebody.
I definitely was too young. I think it was like 1997. My dad was really cool. My dad's a musician.
Oh.
And he used to, when I got into guitar and got into music, he would be really supportive of like taking me to shows, or if there was a band I like, he would take me. Like I saw the Foo Fighters first concert they ever did in LA, and my dad even let me go in the mosh pit with him. Like it was just, he was
cool
that way. Take, you know, don't tell your mother, you're not gonna tomorrow, we're gonna go see a concert. So one of the bands they were playing at the Coach House in San Juan Capistrano was this band Cheap Trick, and he's like, I saw this band open for Kiss in the 70s and they blew my mind, and you have to see them. And I remember I was like, okay, I didn't know much about them, and I was 15, I think, 15, okay, 14 years old, and I go see them, and like Rick Nielsen comes out and just has this beard with guitar picks hanging on it and all the crazy guitars. And they just blew my mind completely. And I'm like, from this day forward, Cheap Trick's my favorite band ever. And I've seen them probably 20 times since then.
And have you got to like interact with them or work with them in any way, or at least meet them?
I did. Yeah, I did. I had a really cool experience one time with an artist I work with named Allie and AJ. They're on more of the pop side, and we had a tour manager, Janine Edwards, that was working with, I think, Def Leppard at the time.
Mm.
And she invited us. Def Leppard, Poison, and Cheap Trick were doing a show, and she said, you guys want to come? And I go, well, yeah, but we're going early because Cheap Trick's the band we got to see, and they're on first.
Right.
And we go to the show, and Robin Zander, the singer Cheap Trick's daughter, happened to be a huge fan of these girls. So we're there, and then, you know, backstage, all the guys and all the bands and their kids are coming up and getting autographs from these girls.
Right.
And I'm sitting there going, you know, I'm with Rick Nielsen and Robin Zander, just kind of chatting with them. And Robin was telling me about the Beatles show they were doing in Vegas at the time. They did the Sgt. Pepper's, they basically played Sgt. Pepper front to back, and they did this big elaborate show with strings, and it was at the Hilton in Las Vegas. And we're sitting there talking. Robin just goes to me, hey man, if you want to come, just, you know, let our tour manager know. We'll put you on the list this weekend. So I go, okay, I'm going to take you up on that. So I call my dad and I go, Cheap Trick just invited me to go to Vegas and see them play. So we immediately, cool, like, you know, the next day or 2 days later, we got in the car and we drove there, and it was cool. They had passes for us. I went back and said hi to the guys, and they were really cool. But it was funny because Robin Zander's daughter, when I showed up, she saw me, but then looked around me and saw that I wasn't with the artist I was working with. And
yeah,
she got all bummed out that those girls weren't there.
Right.
Again.
Who are those girls? I saw that on your Instagram, and I was asking my girlfriend because I never heard of them. She's like, oh yeah, those girls are big.
Yeah. Allie and AJ they started off kind of in the Hollywood Records scene. That's when I met them in about 2008.
Okay.
With, you know, the Miley Cyruses of the world,
right,
and that kind of, okay, pop genre. And they were part of that machine, but they since kind of stopped doing music and went into acting and were very successful doing that.
Okay.
And in the last 3 or 4 years, kind of DIY on their own, came back doing music they wanted to do their way, and have grown it back into like a really successful touring operation, and they have a very loyal following doing the new stuff. That's really good.
So, that's the way to, like some of those girl acts, I mean, like the Olsen twins, I mean, they just start out as these little kid actors and then they've grown it into this empire. So it's pretty crazy if you can parlay all that stuff and just keep going.
Yeah, they're cool. And I kind of tell people they should give them a second look if they kind of remember them from that era, because you know, they're doing it the way they want to do it on their own, doing albums how they want, which is very cool now. And when they've gone out, it started small and is gradually built back up into something kind of big again.
So back to you. So like you said, Cheap Trick, not till you're 15, but you started playing guitar at 11. So who inspired you to play guitar? I mean, there must have been some other influences, or were you just doing it to get girls, or was
that... Well, definitely didn't get girls.
Oh,
that was
really?
At
that, with that skill level?
I'm either going to play sports or I'm going to play music, and I wasn't built for sport.
Okay.
No, I just got into it. I think that was like the era coming right out of like Nirvana and that whole scene. And
sure.
I just thought it was, you know, the cooler kids older than me liked all that, and it got me into it. And then there were bands that I felt, I got into like early kind of, you know, Green Day, that then led me down to like older punk rock bands that they were into.
Okay.
And then as I continued to kind of, once I got into high school and kind of just checked out and was like, this is what I'm doing, it took me into more like the heavy metal, hard rock stuff. And then when I got to like the Joe Satrianis and Steve Vais, Yngwie Malmsteens, I was like, oh, okay, I'm just going to be a nerd and try to do this.
Could you do that stuff?
I'm not like them. I don't think so.
Yeah, they're pretty amazing.
I was definitely like the shreddy guitar kind of stuff is what I got really into for years.
Okay.
And then,
Oh, okay.
That was basically it. That took me down that path. And then, you know, once I was 16 and, you know, playing guitar 8 hours a day, it did put me in a position for like, you know, I could go in the LA Weekly and, you know, somebody needs a guitar player in a band and I could go audition, and I was getting in bands of guys much older than me.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, you started playing with these older bandmates. Like, so how did you first get involved with these other music? Like, do you remember the first time you played on stage? Like, how old
honestly
were you when that happened?
The weirdest, the first time I ever played on stage was with my dad's band at the Four. He was the lounge piano player at the Four Seasons Hotel in Beverly Hills.
Okay.
And it was on New Year's Eve. And they did their big party band thing, and I came and played, and George Thorogood got up and did Gloria with us. So I get to say my first gig ever was with George Thorogood, technically.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah,
wow.
It was cool.
Did you know who he was at that time? Because I bet a lot of
No, I knew Bad to the Bone. Like,
yeah, that's
the
a great song.
Bad to the Bone. I go, cool. That's he was really sweet and supportive and like cool. And so, you know, I definitely got to feel a little cool at school the next week, but, yeah, the bands I was in, you know, started with like local bands in my hometown. I grew up 30 miles north of LA in a town, Valencia, which is, people who know California, Six Flags. That's where that is.
Okay.
And there was two ways to get in bands at that time. I remember this is pre kind of internet, was like LA Weekly would have some listings, and then a magazine called Music Connection would have classifieds for people looking for guys in bands. So I responded to a few of those and, you know, ended up in a band with a heavy metal drug dealer that didn't work out. And one of them ended up, you know, there were some weird ones along the way, but
sure.
There were a couple really cool ones. One I got in, you know, had a hired gun drummer that was in the band Berlin, and they were like probably the most serious thing. It was probably like right around, this was coming up to like 2000 when like Linkin Park was like breaking, and a lot of that electronic kind of mixed with heavy rock guitars thing was happening.
Absolutely.
And we did pretty well. I mean, we had, you know, we could do really well in clubs in and around LA. The guys, Korn at the time, had a label and imprint on Interscope that came out to see us, and we were in talks with them. And
oh, wow.
It was,
so that's,
you know, it was my
close.
First, it was my first time of saying like, whoa, this, I could be in a real band now. And
yeah, you definitely can. So it wasn't long after, you know, being in all these bands and stuff, you get your first touring gig with Kelly Osbourne. Ozzy Osbourne's daughter, right? She asked you to join her band. Like, how did she find you? And like, did you get the call from Sharon or was it somebody else? Or did you have to try out? Like, walk me through this whole process. Cause this is a pretty big break that you got, right?
Yeah. That was like the classic LA cattle call. Like,
really?
Seen a movie where there's 500 guitar players in a line outside of a rehearsal studio.
Was it really, you think 500?
Well, I mean, I could be exaggerating, but it was a lot.
Okay.
And there are a couple different headhunters in Los Angeles that do this type of thing. And sometimes that is the case. And I was 18 years old. I was right out of high school. And through a mutual connection, somebody said, yeah, this guy who owns this rehearsal studio, they're doing an audition for Kelly Osbourne. And at this time, they were like the most famous people on the planet.
Because sure.
The Osbournes was massive on MTV. So, I went down completely green, you know, just did my thing and got a call, myself and another guitar player named Matt Dozat. They were like, we're going to pick you two guys to come do this. You leave in a week. We're going to London. Hope you got you have a passport. I was like, awesome.
So somebody else that did, it wasn't Sharon or Ozzy or Kelly or anything like that.
They weren't there. No.
Okay.
It was a kind of thing. They put bands together. I can't remember if they had like, I don't know. I can't remember exactly how that worked out, but I think they were sending videos and or somebody else was kind of filtering down a group of.
Maybe they showed the top 10 to them or something like that.
It was something like that. That seems to happen.
So So tell me about that experience. What you worked with her for was like a year and a half, 2 years, a couple of years.
It was amazing. And it was like, I definitely, you know, was shot out of a cannon going into that. And then, you know, even for me, it was like our entire road crew and security and everybody were all Ozzy's guys. And they'd put us rehearsing next door to Ozzy and Zach Wilde and Trujillo and, you know, Mike Gordon. And we'd get to like just walk in there and, you know, hang with Ozzy. And I'm going, this is absolutely insane and awesome. And at that time, you know, she was, like I said, the family were so famous again. Mm-hmm. Like, it was, you know, every award show all over the world. And then we did the Robbie Williams, he's a big star here, but he's a massive star in Europe.
That's right. Yeah.
Did a stadium tour and we got to be the opening act on that tour with The Darkness at the time. They were a new band.
I love The Darkness.
Yeah. There were shows that we did like club shows back then where The Darkness were the opening act. And I remember just walking out going, this band is unbelievable. And he had his full leotard outfit on and everything. Justin Hopkins.
Yeah.
That tour was insane. Like we did three nights at Nebworth, which was the record at the time. I think before that Oasis did two and Zeppelin did one, and it's, you know, 175,000 people, three nights in a row.
Jeez.
So that was like, you know, that was like my first year out of high school was getting to do really cool stuff like that as a hired gun for somebody.
Wow. And, when you're a hired gun like that, I mean, what is the relationship with you and are you and Kelly Osbourne kind of like friends or is it kind of like you're almost like the waiter or something? Like how does that relationship work?
I've been fortunate. I haven't talked to Kelly in years, mm-hmm. but at that time we were pretty close and I've been fortunate. Most people I've worked with, there's a really fun dynamic of mm-hmm. like friendship because I mean, it is weird. You're a traveling circus. Basically you're on the road, you're living with these people. And I have heard stories from other people, but I've been fortunate that the acts I've been able to work with have been really cool and fun to be around.
That's cool. So yeah. So then the next one is Avril Lavigne. I mean, that's a huge one. Again, I didn't know that until I started doing the research because I knew Sebastian Bach, but I was like, oh my God, Avril Lavigne's guitar player. That's even bigger than Sebastian Bach. So, and you're also the musical director for her. So what does that mean to be the musical director? What does that job entail really?
So that happened. The timeline from that was, so the Kelly Osbourne thing ends
mm-hmm.
and you know, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just now, you know, I'm 19 now, just bumming around LA, you know, thinking it's like, oh, you just get gigs like super easy. This is like, guy's going to call me again next week and there's going to be another amazing thing to go do. Mm-hmm. And that's not happening. And then, I end up meeting the singer of this band named Treble Charger from Canada, who
right.
was very successful in Canada. Nobody really knew him in the States. And he said, we have a tour opening for Sum 41 in arenas in Canada. We need a guitar player. My guitar player quit. So I said, I'll go up and do that. And that was fun because now I'm touring with like rock bands, and it was still that era where it was just completely wild and nuts. And it was just absolutely insane. So right around that time, the singer of that band was neighbors with Avril Lavigne randomly.
Huh.
And so I had met her, and then I'd met her and her band doing radio shows with Kelly Osbourne. Like, you know, there are all these radio stations always have their like, you know, Jingle Ball, Summer Fest show. And I'm sorry if that bounced in there. So I'd known her for a while. So I was working with this band. We were going to start a record. It wasn't going well. It was like the singer of that band was a producer as well. So he was just distracted. Like he was flying back to LA. They were based in Toronto. So I'd moved to Toronto. I was like living in this guy's condo, like trying to get a record done, and it was going horribly. And one day Avril called me and she said, my guitar player is quitting. He got his own record deal. He was going to go do his own thing.
Mm.
And can you come join my band? I'm like, sign me up, done. Like I'm leaving. And I was like, doing it. Let's go. So
is it, how does she have your number though? Does she just,
well, like, I'd known her at that point.
Okay.
And then, she, you know, I got really close with the Sum 41 guys, and she was married to Derek Whibley from Sum 41
right.
at the time.
Yeah.
Or was dating him at the time. She wasn't married yet, but, yeah, so that was basically it. Her old guitar player decided, Evan said he was going to go out and do his own thing, and she needed somebody, and she was like massive at this time. She'd just come out selling, you know, 20 million of her first record, and the second record had just come out. And yeah, that was like years of my life of just touring nonstop and being gone. And that was learning like the real work of touring. That was like, okay, now we're in it. Now I'm gone. Like 2005, I think I was home for 7 days non-consecutive, like being gone completely.
Wow. And so your first show with her was this thing in New York, and you had to learn the mandolin, and you didn't even know how to play that. You had a few days to learn an entire instrument. Is that hard?
You know, like when, you often think like, oh, obviously everything is always very organized and everyone knows what's happening and what's going
sure.
on. And that was definitely in that instance, not the case. It was, I had flown out a week early to kind of just get the lay of the land of what was going on. Cause it was literally going to be like pass the baton. This guy leaves. I'm on stage that night. Like there was no downtime. It was like they were out and working. And so one of the things was this, show called Fashion Rocks, where they pair you up with people. So it was, Johnny Resnick from the Goo Goo Dolls and Avril were doing Iris at this big show. And Johnny shows up at the rehearsal and I'm just kind of sitting there because I'm just supposed to be there like watching. And somebody in the room's like, who's going to play the mandolin on this song? Like it's the big part of this song. It's like a massive, it's like the opening hook of the song. And everyone's just kind of like, I don't know. And then it was like, you should just do it. And I've never even touched a mandolin before. And I go, I guess we got to figure this out. Tour manager finds one at SIR in New York, gets it to my room. I'm sitting there just trying to like figure out, you know, this is pre-YouTube. I couldn't go watch some guy play
crap.
It.
Yeah.
I'm just like trying to hear each note and play it. And we did it. It probably wasn't great, but it did the job at least. And I remember talking to Johnny Resnick's tech years later, and he was like, how'd you figure out the tuning? I go, what tune? Yeah. He's like, oh, it's tuned this special way. You literally move one finger up and down. I go, that would have been great to know that. Like literally, you see me in the video. I'm sitting down looking at it like I'm, you know, some bluegrass player that doesn't know what he's doing.
But you did it. So you got through. So yeah, like you said, I mean, it's Avril Lavigne at arguably the peak of her career, right? The peak of her popularity. So all the shows and touring that you did with Avril, is there one or like some of those shows or parties or events that like really stand out to you? Like you must have had some run-ins with some like really big rock stars or really famous people at that time, right?
Of course, yeah. Yeah, there were some. I mean, due to NDA, I might not discuss some of them, but...
Do you really have to sign NDAs?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of acts you do sign NDAs with. For
really?
You're out with them, yeah.
I did not know that. Like Avril makes you sign it, or are you saying the other people, or both?
I can't remember if I signed one with her, honestly.
Huh.
That's why I'm saying that. I go, I got to kind of remember who I did and who I didn't. So I don't.
Oh, gotcha. Gotcha.
No, a show with her that was really memorable for me, back to, you know, my love of Cheap Trick, was we did three nights at the Budokan in Tokyo, which is where Cheap Trick's famous live album was from.
Live at Budokan. Yeah.
Yeah. And so in one of the nights, our opening act is this guy named Butch Walker, who's an unbelievable solo artist. Yeah. And a producer. He'd written some of Avril's hits with her. And, I go, if you know how that record starts, it starts with the guy going, "All right, Tokyo, are you ready?" It's the intro to Cheap Trick. I go, I'm going to intro Butch Walker with that. Like, let's do that intro again. And Butch made a live from Budokan DVD of this show, which was kind of cool. But that one just stood out because it was like, yeah, this is my favorite album ever was recorded here. And this is cool. We're doing it.
That's very cool. Yeah. So yeah, talk about working with Butch, because I mean, he's worked with, he was, I don't know, a lot of people probably don't know this, but he was in like a hair band called South Gang. He played guitar player. That's how I first found him. Then he was in this band called The Marvelous Three. But since he's gone on to be a producer, he's worked with like, and songwriter with Train, Taylor Swift, Green Day, Weezer. I mean, you guys did some live stuff, I think, together. But did you ever work with him in the songwriting or producing capacity? Because like, or what is it about him that allows him to work with such high, so many high level talent people and get so much work? Does he just like not sleep, or like, what is the secret to that guy's success?
He's just great. Like you, I mean, I knew of Butch from Marvelous Three.
Yeah.
And that was like, you know, when we talk about that time of like what was going on, like musically, let's say 99, 2000, like, you know, I remember hearing this record Ready, Sex, Go that they did, and I go, this album rocks. Mm-hmm. This is so cool. And it's like, you know, lyrically, musically, it just kicked ass. And I couldn't understand why this wasn't like the biggest band in the world.
I thought the same. Yeah.
I became friendly with Butch just by like reaching out to him. Like I would be in Atlanta doing a show, even back with like Kelly Osbourne or somebody. I'd go, I'm in town, man. You want to hang out? And write me back. Okay. Probably very confused. Our first night hanging out was like going out and getting completely smashed. And a guy parked the car in his studio and we let the air out of the guy's tires. It was just like a wild night. And we were just buddies ever since.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And it's, I've been fortunate that I've been able to like work in so many circles where, you know, Butch is kind of the guy at the core of a lot of things. And it is just, I think it's because he's just so immensely talented. And anyone who gets into his solo work and even works with him realizes that
he's got to have a high work ethic too, though, because I mean, you just look at his resume and his discography, like all these things that he's done. I'm like, how does he even have time to do all this? It's just fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, well, that on top of he tours as he's his own artist.
Yeah, too. He's a solo guy too.
Yeah,
right?
He makes his own records and goes out on his tours.
So he
does it all.
So working with him, that led you to working with Pink. So tell me about working with her. You got to play So What? I love that song.
It was, yeah. We that was...
Was that kind of a one-off or was that...
Yeah, that was an interesting time. We were in talks. I was going to do a tour with them.
Oh.
They wanted somebody... They called me. It came through Butch and one other person. And they'd called me. And what they were looking for was kind of the utility guy. And I'd never done that. It was like, we need you to play keys and guitar. She has an unbelievable guitar player, this guy named Justin Derrico. And so they wanted to kind of fill out the sound and do like, well, we want double guitar in some songs. And then some songs we want keyboards. And I was working with an artist already at that time, but it was like, come out and, you know, do some rehearsals with us and see how it goes. The rehearsals went great. We were doing a couple TV shows and I go MTV Video Music Awards and some things. So I did that. And then the tour manager was like, you know, we're about to leave for 2 years. And I was like, oh, I got to think about this one. That's a long time to be
2 years straight.
Well, and then on top of it, it was like, and you know, that 80-20 keyboard guitar thing, we're going to flip that. We need you on keyboards, 80%, 20% guitar. And I go, there's so many better people for that. I don't even know if I can do that. Like, you know, some of those songs are beyond me being able to do those on keys. So I was like, you know, it was like, let's not do that. we're not going to do
so
that.
So you basically turned it down.
It was pretty mutual. I think we understood once it was defined kind of what everyone was looking at, the length of time, and that it wasn't really like, I thought I was going in, we're doing two guitars.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Justin can be the shredder and I'll be the rhythm guy.
Mm.
But
you want to be the shredder anyways, right? That's
exactly
the best,
yeah,
that's the better thing to do.
Exactly.
So then that leads to I don't know how, or you tell me how'd Sebastian Bach find you? Like, did you have to audition, or you got to tell me the story of that first meeting, because he is a character. I love Sebastian Bach stories. Hopefully you didn't sign an NDA for that one.
No, definitely not. He's got some amazing stories.
Yeah.
No, working with him started, that came through Duff McKagan from Guns N' Roses.
I love Duff. How'd you find him? Or how did you know him?
I met Duff through a mutual friend that I work with, who happened, he was the drummer in Loaded for a while.
Okay.
Duff's solo band.
Yeah.
So I became friendly with Duff, and Sebastian was working on a record. He had like a song from John 5, song idea from John 5, one or two from Steve Stevens, and that was it. Mm. And he needed to get a record done. And he was in the studio with Bob Marlette, and Duff came in to work with him. And I don't know, I think Duff just was like, you know, do you want to come in and do this with us? Like, I think you might be good to come in and like work on a song. Let's just go in and do a song. I go, I'll go do a song with Sebastian Bach. Hell yeah.
Were like, you a fan of Sebastian Bach?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Oh, nice. My God. Yeah, Slave of the Grind. I remember that record, like,
yes,
listening to, like, going, the opening of that record just hit me in the head. Yeah, I love Sebastian Bach. I'm like, this is awesome. And it was like, you know, I want to do a rock record like this. This sounds killer.
Yeah.
So we go in and we write a song in like 15 minutes. And it's great. And then it was like, Sebastian goes, you know, Duff's busy and's doing other stuff. But Sebastian's like, can you come in again tomorrow? Yeah, let's do it. So it turned into me doing like 9 songs on the album with him, where I just came in. We wrote the record. I tracked most of the guitars on the record, tracked a lot of the bass. It was very just like, write it, go record it.
What was the first song that you guys did in 15 minutes?
It was a song called Harmony.
Okay. That's on there, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. And so was that the first time that you kind of were given, like, because I think with Avril Lavigne, I don't think you ever, did you even appear on any of the actual albums, or you didn't do a lot of songwriting with her, right?
I did. I wrote a song with her that never got recorded. And the fortunate thing was I was able to get a publishing deal out of it at the time. So that was a good deal.
Okay, nice.
Yeah, that was, I mean, when you're talking about somebody like her, she has, you know, every mega songwriter in the world's coming at her with serious hits.
Absolutely.
And, you know, when you're just like, hey, I got an idea over here.
You're competing with like, yeah. Some,
and I don't
the
think
Butch
I'm a
Walkers
great pop songwriter. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Butch is so, you know, I'm not going to beat Butch on a song for sure.
So with Sebastian Bach, you're almost kind of like a member of the band. I mean, he's letting you write songs and record all these guitar parts.
So that was, I got brought in just to be, yeah, I was just doing the record with him, but he tours so constantly that it was, during sessions, it'd be, I have a festival show this week, can you come do it? Like, cause he didn't have a guitar player and he's, I got to go fly out and do this festival in Canada. I go, all right, I guess, you know, I got to learn all the Skid Row songs now, which to me was amazing. And so that's how that's
cool.
Started, where we would just be in the middle of doing the album and I would fly out and do these random one-off shows with him. And then sometimes it would be like, oh, we have 2 weeks with us and Rat headlining with Dawkin and Lita Ford. I go, this is awesome. This is like,
that's
a time
cool
machine to heavy metal parking lot. I go, I'm in.
That's cool. I didn't know if you were like a fan, because I'm, you know, I'm seeing all these different artists you work with. I'm like, there's got to be some that you're like, this is okay. But like, so you're really into that scene and stuff, and you're a fan of it.
Yeah. I mean, that's my, you know, the core of where I come from is that music.
That's
that
really cool.
Metal.
So, but like when John 5 and Steve Stevens are laying their tracks down for that album, had they already done there, or were you able to watch them? Because I think that would be cool as a guitar player to just like watch them play and see how they do it in the studio.
I know Steve Stevens, I think, did his tracks at his place.
Oh, really?
And then, and then I redid some of the rhythm guitars, and then, you know, all his solos, and we co-wrote one song, but not together. We basically, like, you know, Steve had the chorus and I did the verse.
Oh, okay.
And then, John 5, I don't know if he came in with Bob Marlette or if he did it at his home studio, because now, I mean, now with the world of,
like, that's true,
remote recording, like
so much
how
of that
this works and sharing files
and Pro Tools and all those crazy things.
It's very efficient. You know, you don't get the same kind of like camaraderie in the room.
Sure.
And I think that's what was cool. Like, you know, when, you know, Sebastian and I currently are trying, to finish up some songs for his next record.
Oh, really? And you're going to be on the new one?
Yeah, yeah. We have some really cool stuff right now. But, you know, we're dealing with COVID and like trying to do it over Zoom and send files and get, whereas before I can have a guitar in the room and he's there and says, no, do this. Yeah, let's go to this section and sing something. And then we're all hyped and it happens.
Oh, see, because I thought you guys had split. I thought he, because he's got Brent Woods.
Yeah,
he's just
amazing.
More the touring guy and you're the studio guy.
Yeah, Brent's been working on the record though too.
Oh,
I mean, the
way,
you know, this... The music industry is very much, especially like in LA, there are all these people that you see often that are all kind of working and it's not uncommon to, you know, pop back in and he's out with this guy now and this person comes back and you're working on this and he's also, there is a camaraderie there. I love Brent. He's amazing.
Yeah, I tried to get him on the show because he was in a band called Wildside. I even liked that band, but he's also worked with Vince Neil, and I mean that guy's a great guitar player for sure.
Yeah, he's in the band with Chris Chaney from Foo Fighters, or Taylor Hawkins from Foo Fighters and Chris Chaney.
That's right. Yeah. I saw that.
Hotel Writers.
Yes, I saw they were on like Fallon or Chevy Kimmel Metal. Or something. Yeah.
Yeah, they got multiple names. Yeah,
that's very cool. So, can you give me any sort of like hints about the new Sebastian, like a song title or a lyric or a theme or anything, or is it all under is it an NDA thing?
No, I mean the stuff I have done with him. It's first of all, one of the songs is like 7 minutes long, epic, like
really
massive. Yeah, and then. It's an extension, you know, I think he wants to go, he pushes it. I mean, he's like the heavy metal Steve Perry. So there's a big canvas for him. So I send him like an idea and then he'll send me back like a vocal and I go, whoa, like that's cool. Like that scream that's what we should do.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So it's still early. I mean, I'm hoping we can get in a room together. Cause I know that's when we worked really fast, like on the last record or when we were in the room with Bob being able to say, that's great. Track it.
Okay. So there's a 7 minute song. Is it going to blow my mind? Is this stuff that's going to be blowing me away? Like,
if it stays that way, I don't know. Things get edited down once you start working and then you bring in,
Who's the producer? Is this Bob Marlette on this one too? Or
I don't know who's going to do this.
Okay.
I mean, there's been some names thrown around, but I'm not sure what they're going to decide to do.
So you're going to, these are just demos then right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Basically. I mean, but now sometimes, you can do, when I'm working with somebody, like I try to produce it like it's a final track at my studio. Like I pretend I'm making the record and send it. So sometimes that does end up on the album.
Oh, okay.
Like sometimes it's like those guitars were great.
Yeah. Like you said, with the technology, I mean, it's crazy. I hear people that self-produce pretty much stuff and it's on Spotify and you can't tell the difference between that and something that was, $1 million studio or whatever. So
there are number one hits that are done in hotel rooms on a laptop.
Really?
It's not. Yeah.
That's crazy. So yeah, I think
there's a video. I think it was Justin Bieber and Skrillex, maybe that DJ producer. I think they did one of his songs, and there's a video of it of them literally like putting the mattress on the wall with a mic in a hotel room and a laptop, and it went number one. I mean, we could get into like a lot of details, but I go
sure.
People like it.
Yeah. I mean, with the computers and stuff, I mean, how much of it, you can fix things. You can fix muffles and things out of key and all that stuff. And then you start to question, is it really music? Is it really a musician playing a song if it's pushing buttons on a computer?
I think you can hear that, like, when there's a performance, especially, in rock.
Yeah.
You hear the performance and there's something that's not perfect about it, or there's some just like real danger in it. I think that comes across to the listener, even if they can't put their finger on it. That's like, yeah, that is much better than if it's quantized and put on the lines chopped up completely.
Right. Yeah. No, that's why I love concerts. I love seeing the music come to life with that energy. And it's not the same watching the online concerts. I want to see it in person. Hope that comes back soon.
Yeah, I know. We'll see. It's hard to know where we're at with that, but
Yeah.
My guess would be a little while still.
Yeah. So other people you work, I mean, you work with Demi Lovato, Mike Posner, Derek Whibley, like you said, from Sum 41. So like when you're working with these big people, like how long does it take to get over the fact that you're working with such a big talent? Like, is it 5 minutes after you meet them, you kind of just move on and forget that? Or is that something that's kind of always on your mind and you sometimes worry about like, oh, I don't want to screw this up for this big person? Or
I don't want to screw anything up ever. Like, sure. So I'm always kind of just, you know, I want to be the guy that shows up and knows everything. I don't want to be figuring something out in the room. Like, you know, I've done gigs with people and the guys are bringing in charts and I go, I just couldn't do that. I need to know what this is. Mm-hmm, like, I'm not going to sit and guess.
Right.
And there's nothing knocking that. It's just saying like, I don't know if it's about the person as much as it's, yeah.
So
that would be,
so just being prepared, I think.
Yeah,
I remember,
I mean, one of those times was, I auditioned to tour with Rihanna and they had just hired Nuno Betancourt from Extreme to be her guitar player.
Yeah. And he's great.
So I came in and it was like the music director, Tony Bruno, was like, all right, in this section of this song, like you guys trade off solos. I go, and that was one of those times where I didn't know. I go, oh man, against Nuno? This will be, I mean, this guy, I love this guy.
Yeah.
I listen to his records. And so that was like one of those times I remember feeling like, oh crap. But it worked out. It was fun.
So you got that gig or?
No, I didn't do that gig.
Okay.
No, I can't remember who ended up doing that.
So what other gigs have you auditioned for that you didn't get? Is there any that you really wish you could have gotten?
One that I submitted, this was a weird one. I got a call from somebody and you had to submit like videos and just information and they were going to review that and then even tell you if they were going to give you an audition. And that was Prince. And I remember being in New York and getting this call and they were being very like not wanting to tell you who this artist was.
Huh.
I said, well, I'm in New York. I'm not going to be there to do. It was going to be like, we're going to call you and you can come over like tomorrow.
Okay.
To do this. And I said, I got to know who it is. Like I will. And they said, it's for Prince. I go, I will be on the next flight out of here. if this is even a chance. And I guess he saw me and saw my videos and was like, no, not that guy. So it didn't end up happening. But I remember sitting there going, that would be so cool if they call me and say, come play with Prince. Cause he was notorious for doing these like, bring you over to his house and do like a 10-hour jam or something at like midnight.
And yeah.
He would feel people out. That's
didn't
how
they,
he would
didn't they play
people.
Basketball? Isn't that the thing on the Chappelle show? I remember them like playing basketball with Prince and like,
I don't remember.
You ever see that
I don't
bit?
Know about that. They, I mean, I never got to meet him. So that was the one I was like, I'm hoping I even get this call.
That would have been amazing. Wow. I mean, you've already worked with some legends, but geez, that would have been, and now it's just sad because he's obviously gone.
Yeah.
But yeah. So like Steve Stevens, I had him on and he was telling me like the reason that him and Billy Idol can work together so long is because he knows like it's Billy's show. Like if ever there's a disagreement, he gives it to Billy. So like, but he has like his solo stuff and his side projects. Like, do you like playing on other people's stuff more or do you like doing your own project? Like, do you have your own project right now, like a solo project or a band?
I do it all. I fell into, you know, when I would be off the road, I would always be working on stuff in my studio. I didn't know what it was for.
Okay.
And I like all types of music, so it wasn't specific to anything. And I fell into doing something called production music for libraries, for TV shows, for commercials. And where, you know, someone would say, we're looking for some rock songs, and I would do some, or we're looking for some stuff that's bluesy, whatever it was. And so I took that as like, I'm very good at like, tell me the task. Like, what are we doing? I think it was David Foster that said, like, I don't write a song unless somebody needs a song. And I can relate to that because I go, you know, I don't just sit there and just do stuff sometimes. I do it better if there's like an ask. Like, let's
really.
Yeah,
so you don't get inspired? Like if something,
I do.
Like if someone dies or something terrible happens, or maybe you're just having a really good day and you just want to like get that out onto a song?
Not so much that, no.
Okay.
It's just more like I treat it kind of as a job where I go, like every day I'm going to sit down and do something.
Okay.
But when there is either a deadline or a task on something, that's when I think I do my best stuff. Oh. And so I got into that. And I built up a massive catalog doing music for different production libraries. Right. And that led me into kind of like saying, well, I kind of want to get more into, you know, doing some more cinematic stuff and some more horror sounding stuff. And I got fortunate. I landed a couple film trailers, which in the world of what we do, those can be pretty lucrative. Those sync licenses, when you land those or commercials. Another guy that does this a lot is Blue Saraceno.
Oh yeah. From Poison. Yeah.
Yeah. He and the guys in Warrant have a catalog. They do a lot of this too.
I think Eric Turner told me about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
It's cool because it's not, you know, with popular music now, it's, if you turn on top 40 radio, it's going to sound a certain way. Uh-huh. It doesn't have a lot of diversity.
Right.
And especially with, well, you know, where I come from and, you know, where like more guitar player rock people come from. So that took me into doing that. And I started my own company to do it. So Noise Candy Music is a company I have. We service, you know, 70 to 100 different clients for every, you know, television, film, trailers, advertising, you know, bespoke corporate work. And we just did a deal with a distributor. So now we're in 40 different countries, and that catalog's growing. That we started that in 2017.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. So like you had a song on The Hills. You had a song on Californication. I mean, these are pretty big shows. So like, do you tune in to watch that episode to hear your song, or is like,
cause sometimes, yeah. Sometimes, if you know it's there, like if you know they've licensed this specific song for this show.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in the last couple of years, we had a trailer for the Joker movie.
Mm.
I need the list in front of me. We had a really good couple of years of like some big, big film campaigns that we were involved with. And some of them were custom making the stuff for it. Some of them was something from our catalog we did.
Oh.
That
so they can go look through the catalog and you've already done stuff and they could just pick and choose what they like.
Yeah. So what we do is we do about an album every 6 weeks and it'll be in a style.
We'll
pick a style. I have a business partner, Adam Parker. And we work with some really talented other writers that collaborate with me, or some collaborate on their own and send us stuff. And yeah, we'll pick a style. Like, you know, one of our records was, I want music that's like intense criminal drug cartel cinematic music, whatever that means. Like think of Narcos meets, you know, Sicario. And we'll craft an album in that style. Another album we did was saying, you know, what if Muse met Tim Burton? What would they do? Like, let's try to do some stuff in that style.
That's an interesting style.
Yeah, that's, and you know, some of it lands and some of it doesn't.
Okay.
And we're really, we seem to do really well in horror and like thriller, that genre. So we double down on a lot of that work.
Okay,
so
that makes sense. More, yeah, because like, it's more guitar driven, I would think, and just, rock.
And yeah, you know, I tend to write darker stuff anyway.
Yeah, so. For sure. So how did you get the nicknames? You have a nickname Evil D or D Rock. How did you get such cool nicknames? It's not like something lame. You got a cool nickname.
Those, I don't know why those are still even written anywhere. Evil D came from...
Is it real though? That's right.
Evan Taubenfeld and I were in a band. He was actually Avril's old guitar player. Him and I had a band for a while. Called the Blacklist Club, and everyone had Evil because the name of his corporation at the time was Big Evil Corporation. So it was always like, you're Evil D.
Okay. That's cool. Do you have any advice for like aspiring guitar players? Is that even a thing now? Do kids want to be guitar players? Everyone wants to be a DJ, but if there was a kid that wanted to be a guitar player.
You know, it's weird because I think now, the change, and there are guys that have adapted to this like masterfully, like Pete Thorne and Tim Pierce, where they're using things like YouTube and using social media. That seems to be a way for a lot of these guys to just get out. I mean, I'll turn on YouTube and I'll see some kid in Japan who's like playing Racer X and it's blowing my, like, it's insane. And you go, you know, wow. But, the music industry is an odd business, but it's a lot of fun. And, you know, don't be a dick is a big one.
There you go.
Be easy to work with. You know, your playing in the gig are 1 hour of the day, the other 23 hours of the day, you got to be a person around other people. So be somebody that people want to be around.
Sure.
That would be the advice I would give anybody.
That's good. Do you think that you're an underrated guitar player? Like, I mean, you've played with some of the biggest rock stars around, but I just don't hear your name a lot when people talk about great guitar players. Like, I mean, I'm trying to do research for this interview and I'm like, why has no one had this guy on their podcast? Like, this is a great guitar player. And I don't know. It's like, do you kind of like it that way? Do you like being under the radar?
Yeah, I don't know. I thank you for saying that, but I also, it's just kind of the world of, you know, I'm often hired to be the hired guy behind mm-hmm. Behind an artist. I'm not there to be out front all the time.
Sure.
Like, so, I think when I was younger, I probably would have had a little more, urgency to be like, man, I wish I was more known for X, Y, and Z. Mm. But as I've gotten older and doing what I do now, and I'm very happy doing it and I love what I'm doing, it's just, it's been great. And I get to see like different opportunities that fill, that scratch that itch. Mm. Like I worked with these DJs, Cruella, who are huge in the EDM world. And that was basically me and Frank Zumo, this drummer. We get to act like Pantera on top of EDM music. Like that was the premise basically. Huh. Like we're going to play this like really hard hitting EDM and you guys do whatever you want on top of it. And I was like, okay, well I'm going to pretend I'm Zach Wilde and, just shred on this or like, play metal riffs on top of this stuff. And getting to do these massive festival shows like Ultra in Brazil for 80,000 people and play metal guitars and see these kids who've never seen a guitar in their life. I go, that's pretty cool. Like there was a lot of leeway there for that kind of stuff.
Okay. And you do producing too, right? You produce some song for this independent artist. Was it Rose? Or I don't know if that's how you say it.
Rose.
Rose. Yeah, and it blew up on TikTok. And
that was very educational for me. Because that was right in the height of COVID. Uh-huh. Nobody knows what's going on. Came through another producer. He said, there's some unsigned artist and she has a song, but she recorded it. She didn't like how it sounded. And would you be able to like help her with it? And I didn't even know what that meant. I go, I don't, okay. And so she wrote me and she basically just said like, I'm self-financing this. I have this song. I listened to the song. It had a good chorus and yeah, the production wasn't great. And I thought, well, how would this work? Like, how would we do this in the age of COVID? Because I'm used to like sending files to people or finishing something on my own, but not the collaborate, like everyone's sending stuff and I got to aggregate it here
okay.
and put it all together. So with my friend Isaac Carpenter from AWOL Nation, him and I got together and we just said, okay, we're producing a song now. And we did it and we sent it to her. She loved it. And then I've never met her. And then I would get text messages from her saying, song's number 10 on iTunes.
Wow.
That's weird. And because I'm not on TikTok, I don't know.
Sure.
That's a whole different world.
Yeah.
I don't even know what it is. I mean, I know it exists, but, then, it'd be a text, the next day. It's now number 4. And I go, there has to be something weird going on here. Like, I go, something's off about this. And then it was like literally like teetering, almost hitting number 1 ahead of like Bring Me the Horizon and all these other big bands. I go, how is this working? And she goes, I put it on TikTok. I have a TikTok channel it's literally just exploded on there.
That's
like
crazy.
And it can drive this like huge like amount of people to whatever you're doing. And then like, Octane, Sirius XM started playing it in heavy rotation every hour. I heard it on the radio numerous times. And I go, this is the new world for people to how to get their stuff out there, it seems.
Absolutely.
And when I started to kind of learn, how that algorithm works with TikTok and with social media, a lot of big top 40 artists, that's how they got their start, was they just posted something on TikTok and it took off.
Mm-hmm. Or and now you can do a lot of that stuff on Instagram too, or Snapchat or all that stuff.
I think any of those platforms, if the audience can access it very quickly, like you can be in front of millions and millions of people immediately.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to pay a fortune for that. You just have to need a lot of people to do that. That's where the labels had value, is they could do that for you. I go, well, now some kid can post a song and it's it's number one song and it's getting nominated for Grammys or whatever. I go, that's pretty wild.
It is pretty. Yeah, it is. It's kind of the good and bad, I guess, because it's almost like it's an oversaturated market too, though, because there's so much music out there. It's like you got to weed through. There's a lot of good stuff, but there's a lot of crap too. So you got to kind of weed through. And also, like, what I might think is crap, other people might love. So, but it's nice that there's so much music out there.
Yeah, I liken it to, like, you know, if you're sitting there at home and you're scrolling through Netflix, and you're like, I don't know what to watch. It's like, of course, you have every option in the world.
Right.
On all these, like,
it's too many.
Too many options. And it's like, you know, it's like going to the Cheesecake Factory. You don't know what to eat. And that was a benefit, you know. Now we'll sound like old guys, but, like, you know, when you go to the record store, it's like, oh that's the new that's the new album on that label that has this band I like. I'm gonna check that out, because it was almost like there's a filter system,
the new releases, and the top they had the top 10 or whatever, then the record store's recommendations,
or even before, you know, radio became, you know, just a giant corporation, when it would be like, oh, that program director and that talent, that station plays really cool stuff, like that, I'm going to hear really awesome stuff there. So that part of it does get a little lost. I don't know. I mean,
so how do you find new music now to listen to? Word of mouth?
Yeah. I'm trying to think of the last, like, unbelievable band somebody turned me on to.
Yeah.
But
let me know. I'm always looking for new music.
There has been a couple. I don't know how new it is. There's a band called Black Map that I really like.
I'll have to check them out.
But I have to look. There, yeah, like you said, there's just so much stuff constantly.
Yeah, let me know.
I do occasionally on, like, on Apple Music or Spotify, we'll look at, like, New Rock Friday or New Music Friday, and just kind of, like, while I'm on a walk, listen to a few of them and see if anything grabs me. But
yeah, I'll listen to they still have the charts or the rock charts, and I'll go through and try to listen to some of the newer stuff. But I think that a lot of the stuff I like is not necessarily popular and doesn't hit the charts and stuff. So I'll find stuff that I'm like, this is like Marvelous Three, like you said, like you find a band like that and you're like, why is this not huge? But I don't, for whatever reason, some of that stuff is not popular, but it's really good.
And these radio stations have, like, you know, their playlist is 20 songs.
Yeah. Exactly.
You're the same songs just on repeat if you're listening to that station.
Yep.
So yeah, it is, it's word of mouth, I think. And, you know, maybe I'm not tuned in, but there are tastemakers out there that are kind of ones to go to hear new stuff.
Absolutely. Well, I saved this question for the end, because if you hung up on me, I was like, well, I got all the rest of the interview, but I have to ask you about the Avril Lavigne conspiracy theory. Have you heard of this, that she was replaced by a doppelganger? I mean, it started out as a joke, but I mean, a lot of people actually believe this. So you worked with her.
I don't even know how to respond to that, because it's like, it seems so, like, cool that a conspiracy theory like that would, like, how does that even
have you heard that though? You've heard it, right?
Yeah. And I know other people on, like, you know, that have been asked this question, and I have the same answer. I don't even know how to, like, answer that. It's, if you think there's a fake person posing as somebody,
there's, I mean, but I there's mean, like, there was one,
I know that answer too. That answer will be analyzed. Like, see how,
you're right. See, that. He won't say, no, there was one for Paul McCartney.
Definitively.
There was one for Paul McCartney too, that I think there's, like, a little, like a mini documentary called, Fall McCartney, or I don't know. It's like this.
There's, about how he was dead.
Yeah, and then that one. Yeah, it was like that. They replaced him with a body double, and I mean,
yeah. Well, there was all. Yeah, it was. Wasn't it because of how he's barefoot in the Abbey Road cover, and the other guys aren't, and his left foot's forward, and the other guy's right foot.
People have too much time on their hands.
They say the walrus is Paul, and the walrus means death. And I go, this is amazing, and it almost makes me go, like, that should be perpetuated. Like, let's keep that going. Like, that's good business.
That stuff is fun though. Remember the one where if you played Pink Floyd, The Wall, he synced it up with The Wizard of Oz. It, like, all these things, like, worked together. Like, how do people find this stuff? It's crazy.
This shows you what a slacker in high school I was, because I took a class. I'm blanking even on what the class was. It was, like, the most, like, what are the easiest classes to take to get my credits? And the teacher, I think it was some sort of marketing class. We did, like, a day of, like, was marketing, and we got to watch The Wizard of Oz with Dark Side of the Moon lined up to it. And it was supposed to be like,
it was
marketing.
Yeah, it was Dark Side of the Moon, not The Wall. Yeah.
Dark Side of the Moon lined up with Wizard of Oz. And I was like, this class rocks.
That is awesome. Wow. That's very
this
cool.
This is my homework.
Absolutely. So you also have a production company. You still have that BN Audio, which makes like audio products?
Yeah. Yeah. BN Audio. That's, I got involved. I took an ownership stake in a company called the Meeks Audio Group, and they do OEM projects, which is original equipment manufacturing. So they basically manage massive projects for companies. So like that microphone you have right there, or anything we get landed here in this country in the consumer electronics or pro audio side gets built somewhere. So I came on, we had this concept for a rock and roll audio brand, and it went well. It was an interesting time. And then we had the nice little Chinese trade war that happened. And you know, that put the brakes on a lot of what we were doing, but that brand, we're morphing into something else.
And we're still
working on a bunch of projects over there. So we have factory partners in Shenzhen and China, and I'm trying to build out the portion of the business where we're going to do pro audio projects or professional projects. So work with, you know, music companies, because that's where I come from. I go, there could be a lot of value and cool stuff we could do in that world.
Awesome. Okay. Well, yeah. People can check that out too. Is there any other career highlights that I've missed? I think we went over almost everything.
I don't, you know, I'm sure there are some, but we went over a lot, so I think we're good.
Very cool. All right. And then do you have, I always like to end with a charity. Is there a charity that you work with or that you want to just give a quick shout out to before we wrap it up?
There's one I think is really cool. I read this book called The Operator by Robert O'Neill. And if you don't know, Robert O'Neill is the Navy SEAL who took the kill shot and killed bin Laden.
Oh, I need to read that.
Yeah, it's a great book. It's amazing. And I mean, the whole book isn't about that. A lot of it's just about what it took to become a Navy SEAL for this guy and what they go through. Oh. And as I'm like reading this, I go, this is the most insane. These guys are unbelievable.
Right.
And then you find out like a lot of them coming out of SEALs have a hard time going into the private sector for work.
Yeah.
A lot of them you have these.
It's like that movie, The Hurt Locker. Do you ever see that?
They're one in a million. Nobody can do what they can do. And then they come out and they're having a hard time finding a job. So he started a charity. I believe it's called the Special Operators Fund. Operators Transition Fund. That's what it is. But it was formerly called Your Grateful Nation. And it's a charity that kind of helps get people into the private sector, into some good jobs.
Oh, because, that sounds amazing. I mean, I love
You know, when you run a business, I would imagine somebody who can go through SEAL training and become that is somebody I would want to work for me.
Absolutely. Like, yeah.
So it helps them.
Just for the stories to tell at break time.
I mean, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
He tells an awesome story too. I mean, you know, these guys don't make a lot of money. Like a lot of these guys, they're doing these missions. And then, you know, they're mowing their own lawn because they can't afford a gardener. And you go, there's something off of here a little bit. So that's one I don't get here talked about a lot, but I really like it. And I like the idea of it.
I love all that too. Thank you so much for doing this. I will put that in the notes. I'll put all your links in the notes as well. So people can check all your stuff out, your website and your social media.
Great, man.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for doing this.
That was a lot of fun. Thank
you. Tell Sebastian I'm going to come get him next.
Absolutely. I'll let him know.
All right. See ya.
See ya.
Bye-bye. Devin Bronson, remember that name. This kid is talented, and people should know who he is. So many great musicians he's worked with, and I'm sure more to come. That was crazy that he almost got to work with Prince. That would have been a great experience for sure, but still, such an amazing resume. I really look forward to that new Sebastian Bach record. That should be a lot of fun. Make sure to follow Devin on social media to keep up with all the cool stuff he's doing. Also, check out his website. It'll be there in the show notes, along with the charity he mentioned, my Instagram, and you can also follow me on Facebook or even Twitter. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure you check out some of the other ones I've done. A lot of great rock stars I've had on, like guitarist Steve Stevens, who we mentioned earlier. And if you want to support the show, you can help me by either liking or following on social media, sharing the episode on social media, or if you really want to go all out, you can write me a review on iTunes. That really helps out quite a bit. Thanks again for listening, and remember, shoot for the moon.